Hello, 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 and welcome to, there we are. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Critical Q&A number 446. Glad you're here today on this Sunday, March 24th in the year of our Lord, 2024. Happy to be joined by everybody here. Seeing everybody in the chats coming on in as we're getting started. Happy Palm Sunday indeed. All right, good. Well, let's get the chat up here and let's get our Q&A turned on. Please, as I always do each week, please put your questions under this comment here. Start Q&A. Oh, and it's Harry Houdini's 150th birthday? My goodness. Wow. Wow. Well, there you go. Earlier this month, wasn't it like Hubbard's 108th or something? I don't know, something like that. Anyway, Benson shows up on Fridays. Jehovah's Witness apostate. So you will see Benson on Fridays. That's when we do our snuggles, not struggles, Cam. But anyway, yes. All right. So go ahead and, as we get going here, I'm sorry for moving the podcast this week from the Speaking of Cults podcast. I was going to go live yesterday and I changed my mind kind of last minute because I realized this is sort of the script for it right here is all these pages. This is, probably, oh gosh, yeah, there's a lot of pages here of stuff to go over with you guys. This is all the sci-fi stuff of Scientology. I drew this from, pulled stuff from Wikipedia, pulled stuff from another wiki, a sci-fi wiki, and put all this stuff together, and holy cow, you know, before Earth and before MEST, bodybuilder incidents, bodies in pawn, fly traps, coffee grinders, and ice cubes, and so much more. Trillions upon trillions of years of fascinating experiences that apparently me and thee and everybody else has had, and we're going to break all that down. But I thought I realized at the last minute after going through all this stuff that there's so much raw data here that if I don't put some graphics or illustrations or something to break up the stream of words that are coming at you and describing all of this stuff, I thought I want to put some stuff together to kind of, you know, maybe not full-blown, you know, PowerPoints, you know, but something. I want to break this up with some stuff. So I'm going to put some things together by Wednesday so that we can walk through this in a live stream. It'll still be the podcast. It will still come out in an audio version as well, of course, it being a podcast. But I didn't want to deliver it without a little bit of breakup of that stuff. And that's why I thought, okay, well, I'll prep a little bit more for that one. Okay. I was thinking of you guys. I hope it was the right move. But I also wanted to do it live because I wanted to, like we did the week before, I wanted to get your kind of feedback and stuff as we go and maybe even questions as we go because I thought it might be kind of fun to have, you know, some back and forth with it. Because this is really, this is a little bit of a, not full, you know, well, a little bit of kind of tongue-in-cheek one. We're going to be a little bit silly on that one. So, because, I mean, let's face it, this stuff is some of the goofiest stuff ever written when it comes to trying to, you know, it's bad sci-fi for one, but it's horrible dogma for another, in terms of it being claiming to be literal truth. I am not aware of what's up with the audio being maybe slightly out with the video. I'm sorry if that's happening. That would be probably a YouTube issue. Yeah. Not. Anyway, not sure what to do about that. I did everything I could today to try to reduce that humming, whining noise that I keep being told is happening as well. I tried over and over again to repeat that audio humming, whining noise, and I had made some adjustments. I could not get it or reproduce it. So I'm got my fingers crossed that it's fixed now. Yeah, no problem. Okay, good. Good, good, good. I'm glad that that whining noise is no longer there. So good, but not quite in sync. That's a YouTube thing that happens, just because of bandwidth issues and stuff. And there's not really a whole lot I can do about that. It certainly isn't any settings or anything I can change to, because it's already on the tightest, non-latency kind of settings I have. So we're going to move on from that. Now let's go ahead and get into the questions, because I see that they are coming in the queue here, which I love. So let's do this thing. First question. I knew fellow staff members that would get shit-faced drunk every Saturday night because they had Sunday off and could still meet the no alcohol 24 hours before work rule. Did you see that kind of behavior? Oh, hell yes, I did. Absolutely. Scientologists have a few hard-bound rules when it comes to the use of alcohol or drugs and auditing and coursework. Basically, you cannot be in a Scientology classroom or be in a auditing session if you have imbibed alcohol within 24 hours of being there. Whether you got drunk or it was just a sip or whatever, you're not supposed to have any alcohol within 24 hours of being in a course room or being in session. And of course, you are not supposed to be taking any kind of illegal medications or drugs. You're not supposed to be taking, even if it is legal, you're not supposed to be smoking any pot or marijuana, right? Or cannabis, whatever you want to call it. And obviously, harder core drugs or anything like that, it would be verboten. You're not actually even supposed to be taking aspirin, Tylenol, painkillers, or any kind of medications, even over-the-counter stuff, without first getting okay through the director of processing if you are getting auditing, or through the director of training or your course supervisor if you're on course going and doing your training. And this does apply to a lesser degree in the public courses, the basic new people courses. They're told the same things. It's a little harder to enforce down there than it is in the Div 4 Academy course room, when people get a little bit more, genned in on this stuff. But that's basically how it works. Now, that all being the rules, people play with and push those rules all the way to the limit all the time because they like their alcohol and they like, they're not supposed to be doing any cannabis at all, right, ever. So that would be, kind of verboten 24 hours or not. Scientology is rabidly in any, against any kind of recreational drug use. Let's put it that way. But if you wanted to get, totally wasted drunk, then you could do that, right? As long as you do it 24 hours and 1 minute before, you're going to need to do any of those things. So anyway, that's kind of the rule. And yes, I saw lots and lots of Scientologists, Sea Org members, especially when it came to the Bosun's party around Christmas time, or the beer and cheese party also in December, or other times when people, would get a leave or, get some time off and, would go make the best of it. Didn't see that often in the Sea Org, but often enough that it certainly I can say it happened. And people are just trying to have their fun. So that's kind of how that works. Okay, and I have three questions also queued up on the other question screen. So let's go ahead and pop over there and pull up our first question from Matt B. And this is from the question queue that people send me. If you want to send me questions for this, you can send them to me at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. And I will put them in my question queue, which is this large text file I've had for years that I just throw all the questions in there and I draw from there to put them up here. So Matt B. asks, both in Scientology and in the Mormon Church, there seems to be a general trend of looking down at McDonald's workers. For example, David Miscavige speaks derisively of ex-Scientologists flipping burgers at McDonald's. In the Mormon Church, people also say if you leave the church, you will end up at McDonald's. There is also a video of an anti-Scientology protest in Clearwater where the Scientologists call the protesters losers and McDonald's workers. What explains this derisive attitude of cult members towards McDonald's workers? Is it simply an extension of the elitism and contempt that cult members have towards mainstream society? It is an extension of, exactly as you say, Matt, the contempt that cult members have toward mainstream society, compounded on top of the general contempt that society truly has towards, you know, and sort of when it engages in a classist sort of attitude towards what are considered low-level, low-skill, menial labor jobs. Field work fits into this, the kind of job that, the kind of service industry jobs that many, many immigrants end up doing, the backbreaking work or the hard work, hard physical labor kind of work, is generally thought of among American elitists as sort of low-class work that only low-class people would be fit for. Not just that low-class people do, it's that that's all they're fit for. And that attitude very much permeates destructive cults. It's all part of the us versus them attitude, which is another way of describing that is a contempt-filled arrogance, a conceit about their status and position because of their enlightened knowledge or position, or because they believe that they are doing the Lord's work, or they are in somehow a senior, superior position because of their beliefs, practices, rituals, or, you know, actions. And that is a human frailty. It is ego and sort of social ego writ large. It's the social hierarchy, you know, it's sort of the dark side of social hierarchies where there has to be a caste or a class system. People automatically create these. We don't really have to think too hard about it. We have to resist it and fight back hard to not let it happen if we don't want it happening, because people just kind of naturally do this. And because groups like Scientology and the Mormons really, truly are destructive cults and really do line up on this checklist or you know, this list of attributes that we can point to, the superiority, the smugness, the sort of contempt that is rife throughout these groups, this is how it comes out. This is the sort of thing where the cult's contempt meets society's sort of bad attitude about, you know, workers, about certain classes of workers. Essential workers also fit into this in so many ways, but at least we recognize in society that essential workers have a skill set to it. McDonald's workers, fast food industry, food work tends to be tends to be thought about as very low skill labor. It's really quite an interesting dichotomy, for lack of a better word, in our society that we are enamored with and love reality cooking shows and competition shows, and we raise up master chefs as celebrities, but we look down in general on the food industry and the people who make our food. I don't really know the sort of derivation of this, where it all comes from, except for this sort of general, you know, derisiveness that we just have to have. I have to feel better about myself, so I'm going to do that by putting down these other people, because we can't just lift everybody up. Oh, no, right? It has to be, I'm going to feel better by making you out to be worse than me. you know, standard human problem. So so when you exacerbate it with a cult, then there's another aspect to this too. Actually, now that I think about it, which is the fact that it's also a statement by the cult that you weren't good enough for us. You weren't strong enough, disciplined enough, ethical enough. So you have to go do that low class, low skill work that we are going to insult you with, right? You have no other choice because you're such a loser. You're such a non-skilled person. You have so little to contribute to society that we're going to be happy to call you out as, you know, oh, well, good luck at McDonald's, motherfucker, right? Like, that's the attitude. And that's exactly what I was told. And that's exactly what so many other Sea Org members were told when we were trying to leave is, well, you're going to be scrubbing dishes at McDonald's. You know, you're going to be flipping burgers at McDonald's. And, you know, Mark Headley has talked about this many times. It's, you know, it's certainly a Miscavigism. But it, you know, but it's just, you know how it is. All right. So that's what I can, there's my answer on that. All right. Let's go back here and carry on. I am not seeing what Red Pill asked there. I just come back and boom. But somehow I'm not surprised he asked a weird question. Okay. So let's come back here. Where's my comment box? There it is. Okay. John O'Nolan, did you ever know someone who lost their love of reading or began to hate reading from applying study tech? Yeah, me. Not really. I mean, kind of. I'll tell you a story. Is when I was a kid, I was... third grade, fourth grade. So probably about 8 or 9, I guess. I don't know, 10 years old. I was having a real time of it reading this Hardy Boys book. And it was, maybe it was a school assignment or it was something that my mom had me doing. Yeah, I think I was just reading it for fun. And I was having a hard time reading a part or something. And my mom wanted me to word clear this, which meant, she started giving me checkouts. After each chapter of the book, she would start asking me the definitions of words randomly in the text and to use them in sentences. And this is a spot check, but it's a methodology of word clearing in Scientology, of checking to see that you've got your words. It's based on what's called a star rate checkout, where you ask a bunch of the definitions of a bunch of words in a text in something you've studied, and then you ask application-type questions or practical-type questions to show that the person actually read it and understands it and can tell it back to you. And my mom, for whatever reason, decided that she was going to give me a star rate checkout chapter by chapter on this Hardy Boys book. And it became, to this day, like I still remember it, because I hit a wall of anxiety and stress and fear that was astounding, even to me. I was crying. I was angry. I was sad. I went through so many emotions and so many ups and downs, a lot of downs, desperately trying to understand these words and fighting every minute of it, right? I wasn't a Scientologist. I was like a 10-year-old, right? I didn't really... to understand any bigger picture. I just understood that my mom wanted me to understand all these words, but I felt like I did understand them, but I couldn't communicate them. And it was so frustrating to be told I didn't understand a thing when I did understand it, even if I couldn't put it into words. And I don't know until just now that I ever thought about it that way, but that's exactly what the crux of the problem was, is I was being told, you don't get this, when I did get it. And I knew I got it. I wasn't confused about it. We did. I don't know what it was that prompted us to start on this, but it. But now that I'm like thinking, telling you about it and thinking it through, it wasn't because I felt, I don't remember it being that I went to her and said, look, I've got this problem. I don't understand this. Can you help me? It was more like, here's something we're going to do. And I was like, okay. And then we started, you know. Anyway, I know she was just trying to help. I don't mean to, you know, get across that my mom was some kind of monster. But she was using Scientology on me. And I didn't understand why. I didn't understand what why I was being told I didn't understand things that I did. And yet I couldn't argue back against it. And I think it was that feeling of helplessness that really did it to me, you know, and this sort of kind of gaslighting a little bit in that I was absolutely being told something that was real. It was true. You don't get this, when I knew that wasn't the case, right? It was just such an assault on my thinking. So anyway, yeah. So that was weird. That was just a weird thing that happened to me when I was a kid. And my mom ended up giving up on it because I was just, you know, I mean, after a couple chapters, I was just laying on the floor crying. I mean, it was really bad. So, yeah. As far as other people go, let me think about this. What I'll say about this is that I ran across more than a few people in Scientology over the years as just a general Scientologist. I ran across plenty of Scientologists who would not use study tech in their pleasure reading. They would use it in the classroom. They would have a dictionary. They would do their thing. But they confessed to, right, that they just couldn't be bothered to do that when they were doing, you know, regular reading of novels and stuff like that, because it just got in the way, or it was just too much of a bother, or it was just unnecessary, right? And I always looked at them a little askance, a little, really, you do that? Because once I became a Scientologist and a course room supervisor and a trained word clearer, I was much more mindful of clearing my misunderstood words, right? I kind of flipped the script on my 10-year-old self, right? Anyway, so yeah. Okay, so there you go on that. Did that not pop up on the screen this whole time? I thought I had it up there. Okay, well, let's carry on. X-Scion asks, I don't remember you talking about your hobbies much. What ones do you have or would like to start? Okay, I'll tell you. I've always liked reading, but I've really, but for pleasure reading, it's been hard. It's been hard to get back into that lately. A couple months ago, I read my first fiction book in years. I think actually since I got out of Scientology, I've been so specialized in nonfiction stuff. I like video games a lot. I play a lot. I've played, I really got into SimCity for some reason recently, SimCity 4. And, because it was like $3 on Steam or something. I was like, what's this now? Because I remembered it when I was a kid. I remember, you know, you could just kind of leave the city going. And, and it would build it, you know, you could set up the city and it would just start going, you know, the city simulator. Anyway, so I've been playing some of that lately. And Stardew Valley, which just had a new update. I've been playing that. That's a very calm, peaceful kind of game. And wow, these commercials are pretty long on here, aren't they? There's the skip button. I couldn't skip it. All right. I'm watching the live stream on here and these commercials come up. Okay. Also, Cult of the Lamb, which I've talked about, and I did talk about maybe streaming some live of me playing that game. One person asked about it one time. I have set up a Twitch account, and I am thinking about doing that at some point. I got to admit, I'm slightly hesitant. I'm a little bit like, is this going to be embarrassing or weird if I do this? But I, you know, I there are things about Cult of the Lamb that could be kind of interesting to talk about while I'm playing it. But it's anyway. Okay, other hobbies I have are, of course, I don't do it a whole lot more lately because we've kind of run out of shelf space to put them. I do like building Lego models. I'm a sort of an adult Lego builder. That's kind of fun as a hobby or as an activity. Of course, you know, all this stuff is kind of hobby-like for me as well as being my job. All this video setup and video work and video editing and all that kind of stuff, right? Let's see if there's anything. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And board gaming with my wife. We do a lot of that. Lots. We play a lot of board games. We probably have about 30 or so different games that we, and we really like Civ games, Civilization style games. So we've got, you know, Terra Mystica and, what's the other one? Well, is it Civilization? There's Through the Ages. There's another game called Through the Ages. There's one called Tapestry, which is really only a Civilization game in name only, but it's kind of a fun one. You know, Terraforming Mars. I happen to personally like, you know, some two people games that my wife is not so much into, so we don't get to play a lot of Stratego. I like Ticket to Ride. That's kind of a fun one. So those kind of games, you know, that kind of stuff. Those are fun. Okay, so let's carry on. Jehovah's Witness apostate. Great question. Did you see the Sea Org member at the Denver Org getting arrested by police for assaulting a guy with a phone? I did hear about this. I saw some still shots, some photos of it. Looked into that the other day because I was like, wait a minute, what? Somebody got arrested in Denver? What's happening here? I had seen two different protesters down at the church here in Denver. And a couple weeks ago, I said kind of, you know, I kind of poo-pooed it a bit, a little, you know, wow, you know, what's the big deal? But then this guy gets arrested. Now, it says Sea Org member, and I keep wondering why they're saying that, because it's a guy in a uniform of the org. It's an ideal org uniform that he's wearing. I wasn't sure if he was a Sea Org member or not, but like I said, I only saw a couple pictures, so I don't know what the deal is, except that he came out, grabbed the guy's camera, and tried to run off or something, and the protester grabbed him, sat on him, and then the police showed up and arrested him, and you know, yeah, that's what'll happen. You know, it's a little bit of a fuck around and find out kind of a situation. You can see his pin on his collar. Oh, got it. Thank you for clarifying. Okay, good. Good, good, good. Small pin on his collar shirt. Got it. Okay, cool. Thanks, guys, for that clarification. There, when somebody asked me, actually, so I'll just, in case you all don't know, when Sea Org members are posted in an ideal org, they wear the staff uniform. That's why it can be hard to differentiate them. But great. So Sea Org member. Anyway, kind of a dumb move on his part, really. But you know, okay. Don't really have a whole lot else to say about that because I don't know too much more about it. Okay, Xion, have you ever done a podcast about Scientology axioms, factors, logics, and pre-logics? I have definitely discussed these over the years on my Q&A show here. I don't know that I've not done a dedicated episode to the Scientology axioms. Okay, let's talk about them for a second. Because I have discussed them in some detail and I've broken or taken apart certain ones, certain really, really important ones, like the ones about alter is and as is and not is and, you know, and isness, right? Those four conditions of existence. I've broken that stuff down for people in the past in some detail, really got into it, and some other things. But I've never really gone over the factors. Ooh, that'd be interesting, actually. That'd be interesting. Because the factors are pretty wild stuff. I wonder if I have... I might have them right here, actually, now that I think about it. I can pull them up and talk about this a little bit. Because there are three or four sets of You could say foundational truths, axioms, self-evident truths, air quotes, of Scientology principles. And these are sort of the things that I think are best described as the things that you have to take on faith in order for Scientology to make any sense at all. And I'm going to, I've got Scientology 0 to 8 here open in front of me. So let's see if I can find the factors. And I'll show you an example of what I'm talking about. Hubbard, okay. There's a Crowley, there was a book published way back in the early 1900s, 1910, 20, something like that. I don't remember exactly when. By a guy named Aleister Crowley, who was a British, you know, kind of magic system occultist, called himself the Beast. You know, he was a real unsavory kind of character, and he was on drugs all the time, and did a lot of writing, and he had really weird, odd spiritual beliefs and occult understandings of things. And he's the one who started got in charge of and took over the Ordo Templi Orientis, the OTO, and sort of created his own system of magic, and it involved sex and blood and rituals, and it was pretty weird stuff. And he wrote a book. He wrote a few books, but he wrote a particular book called The Book of the Law. And this book had axioms in it. And for whatever reason, in addition, it had all these sayings and all this weird stuff in it, and then it had these axioms, these principles that were true in magic, I guess. And it's really, really hard to read. It's very arcane, weird, gobbledygooky stuff. But I believe Hubbard was inspired in 1951 to write the axioms of Dianetics, and then later create another body of axioms called the Axioms of Scientology. And there are hundreds of these things. And if we go looking for them, here they are. They're on page 53. There they are, page 30. All right, so let's go down to these real fast. Since we're talking about these. Uh-oh, come on now. All right. Sorry, this is going to take me a second to get down here to them. Thank you for your patience as I thumb through this book here down to... Okay, down to page 30, which basically means, what are we dealing with here? Maybe about page 60. Let's try that. Here we go. Here are the axioms. All right. Oh, boy, there are so many. I ended up at axiom 69. Okay, Axioms of Dianetics from November 1951. Axiom 1, the source of life is a static of peculiar and particular properties. Axiom 2, at least a portion of the static called life is impinged upon the physical universe. Axiom 3, that portion of the static of life which is impinged upon the physical universe has for its dynamic goal survival, and only survival. If you can't kill a Thetan, then why would that be its only goal? I mean, you know, these things are self-evident truths that I have so many questions about almost immediately. Axiom 4, this is the Dianetics axioms. The physical universe is reducible to motion of energy operating in space through time. Okay, you know, this kind of thing. So, you know, the life stat, axiom 7, the life static is engaged in a conquest of the physical universe. Groovy. So those are your Dianetics axioms. That's kind of the flavor of these things. And then you get down to, let's see here, let's go to page 80, see where we're at. Pre-logics. Okay, the Axioms of Scientology come around in 1954, originally put out in a book called The Creation of Human Ability. And axiom one of the Scientology axioms, which sort of build on, I guess you could say, the Dianetic axioms, life is basically a static. Here we are with this static thing again. Well, what's that? Well, definition. A life static has no mass, no motion, no wavelength, no location in space or in time. It has the ability to postulate and perceive. Okay, so I think we've sort of seen what this is about here as far as what these things are. And they represent the most fundamental truths of Scientology, right? And the factors are another kind of version of this. I think there's 20 or 30 of them or something. And they sort of tell the story of a Thetan and the story of how we all came together in this universe. And, you know, in the beginning, there was a purpose and the purpose was to survive or something like that. Anyway, you guys can look these things up. But they're basically Hubbard's best efforts at trying to write some scriptural type stuff inspired by Aleister Crowley to make or give credibility and legitimacy to Hubbard's wild ideas of the early 1950s. You know, basically in a nutshell, that's what they are. And that's what I will say about them today. Xion, how many assists are there, and did you have or see any success using them? There are hundreds of assists. There are a few core basic assists that get used all the time in Scientology, which is your touch assist, nerve assist, and contact assist. There is a bring back to life assist. There are, you know, a wide array of assists that are all designed to not audit a person, but sort of a semi-auditing. They're kind of like semi-spiritual, you know. They're sort of trying to orient or adjust your body to its situation and your spirit to get in tune with the body, because things have kind of fallen out of alignment somehow. You hurt yourself, or you experience some big loss, or you're all put out for some reason, or you're stressing, or you're freaking, or you're in pain. And assists are designed to try to help that, whether it's nerve channel assist with a nerve assist, or whether it's, you know, touching your body in different places to put your attention in different places of your body to distract and smooth out, you know, missed attention that's kind of all over the place because you hurt yourself. It's this kind of idea, this kind of thinking. There's a lot of, you know, flowery words around the description of these things, but basically that's what they are. And did I see any success in using them? Not really. There were people who wrote some pretty glowing success stories about some assists that they would get from time to time. My back is readjusted. I could feel the bones adjusting themselves as I was going through my nerve assist. You know, you get this kind of stuff, which to me is about as equivalent as somebody saying that they can detect the saline content of their cells now that they've done superpower. I mean, it just smacks of utter ridiculousness. But that doesn't mean people can't feel or experience it, right? People can feel or experience anything they want in whatever moment they want to when their belief is hard enough, right? We all know this. So, you know, you get those kind of testimonials from time to time, but I've never seen anybody really cure any kind of real serious physical illness or even a cold or an infection or anything like that with an assist. It's really just kind of a big placebo kind of thing that they do in Scientology. It makes people feel like they're doing something about a thing that is wrong that you really can't do anything about. Some people have a real hard time with that, you know, and I went over recently a few weeks ago, right, the power of feeling like something can be done about it. If you put somebody in a position where they feel like they are doing something, even if they're not doing anything effective or useful, but they feel like they are, you're going to have a happier or at least a less stressed, less anxious person on your hands. It's a wonderful way to, you know, to help somebody out, give them something to do, give them something purposeful. But when it's not any really doing any good, you know, it just becomes a bit of an illusion of usefulness. And that's kind of what assists are, as far as I can tell. Oh, it's a great question. Jehovah's Witness apostate. How does Scientology explain to its members about Mary Sue going to prison for LRH? They don't. Nobody in Scientology knows about that. They don't talk about it. I didn't find out about any of that until after I got out of Scientology. I knew that there was a raid and that there had been some government problem, but I didn't know any of the details, and nobody was keen to tell me. And I got in Scientology in the 80s, just years after it happened. Nobody was talking about it. And if you brought it up, it was sort of, you know, and I don't mean I brought it up. I just mean if you bring up things like that, you get looks, you know, you get this kind of, you know, things get quiet. Oh, yeah, I don't think we're supposed to be talking about that kind of stuff. You know, you guys know what I'm talking about, right? You get that sort of, everybody's suddenly like, you know, on shaky ground. So, no, they just don't talk about that. And I guess I imagine if they were going to talk about it, they talk about it the same way they talk about all the rest of it, which is they just tell lies about it. You know, at the time that Operation Snow White went down, or the Snow White Project or whatever it was called, you know, when that whole thing was blown up, Scientologists were told in all seriousness that the church was being harassed by the government. The government had conspired to frame these Scientologists, and all that they had really been guilty of was using copy paper or stealing some paper or something, or taking paper. Like, it was dumbed down for the Scientologists to the stupidest possible explanation for what had happened. And they, you know, of course, like cult members, they just kind of accepted it and went with it. And historically speaking, it was just kind of tamped out of existence. You know, usual historical revisionism, right? 101, cult revisionism. Okay, let's move on here. Ex-Scion, your show about selling Scientology and registrars made me wonder, do all regs have access to your PC folders? They're not supposed to, but yes, they do. I saw many regs many times up in the HGC, which is where the auditing is delivered, looking through people's PC folders. I saw regs being chastised for that also. I saw regs being kicked out of the HGC. I saw regs being told, no, you cannot have that information. So I saw all of it, right? I saw the full spectrum of that. So sometimes confidentiality and privacy was enforced. Sometimes it wasn't. I saw that in Santa Barbara. I saw that in Ventura at the mission there. I saw people, executives and registrars going through PC folders. And I saw that at ASHO, at the Sea Org there. I saw regs going through PC folders. I did not see it at LA Org. I saw executives of Scientology who held registrar functions going through PC folders in class 5 orgs out in the regular orgs, right out in the churches. So yeah, it's all that. I just kind of popping through my memories there. Yeah, absolutely. I saw also ethics officers, qual staff, which is the quality control division area of Scientology. I saw those guys going through PC folders that they didn't necessarily or shouldn't necessarily have had access to. Yeah, those are the... Oh, and of course, OSA. I saw OSA guys going through PC folders all the time. All the time. So, yeah, that's what I saw. This is an interesting question. Let me see if I can decipher this one. Anthony Spurgeon asks, is there a movie for you where another movie should be made about the behind-the-scenes production story? For me, it would be The Wizard of Oz. I love that movie, but it's horrifying behind the scenes. Oh, yeah. All the movies I'd be interested in seeing on that have had that done. I have seen more documentaries about behind the scenes of Star Wars movies over the years. I mean, all the way back to the 1970s, I aspired to be a special effects artist. I wanted to do that work for a living. I wanted to be Phil Tippett, the guy who did a lot of the model work and stuff, and Adam Savage. You know, that guy, to me, has had the dream career, right? Model building and Mythbusters and all that. Holy cow, what a fun life. I used to, when I, my first professional interest was special effects for film. And then I wanted to do film direction. I wanted to actually be a director and follow in Spielberg's shoes. I was riveted to Steven Spielberg and George Lucas's movies when I was growing up. I was very much a child of New Hollywood in that way. Oh my gosh, so aspired to that. So I would eat up every documentary I could find about the behind the scenes, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Jaws, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Star Wars, Poltergeist. I'm thinking of the movies that I saw behind the scenes documentaries of. I saw stuff for all of these movies. Back to the Future, Space 1999, Star Trek, of course, every Star Trek documentary. Hell, I read books about the making of Star Wars. I remember reading about behind the scenes of Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi. The prequels, definitely saw the documentary behind the scenes stuff on that. So all the ones I've wanted to see existed, you know. I'd be, oh yeah, the Batman movies, the Christopher Nolan films. You know, I've watched so much video, so many interviews, so many things breaking down how they made these movies, what the directors were thinking, what the screenwriters were thinking, the producers, the movie stars, everybody. I'm fascinated, absolutely fascinated. In fact, talk about an answer to a hobby question. I guess I didn't really think about this, but really following and dissecting how stuff gets made has always been a passion of mine. Writing as well when it comes to that, but you asked about movies. Terminator movies, I saw documentaries on those. So I don't know. Princess Bride. I think I'm struggling to find one that would be made for something that hasn't been made. Yeah. I never did see. I read an awful lot, OBG Foster. I read an awful lot about Babylon 5 and the making of it, but I never saw a production about it. I didn't know. I don't even know if they were. You know, it was so low budget when they were doing it. I don't think anybody was documenting what they were doing while they were doing it, producing that particular show. It's hard to find behind the scenes on that stuff. Oh, God, yes, Time Bandits. So funny you mentioned that. I just saw it in the theater a couple weeks ago. That would be good. To see some behind the scenes on. I read about Time Bandits and how it was produced. They had to get George Harrison from the Beatles to stake the movie to fund it as a producer because nobody would pay for it, but it was so good. All right. Not a lot on, that's an interesting question Hans Christian brings up. No, not a lot on Harry Potter, actually. It never really dived too deep into it. I read a lot and saw a lot of interviews from the stars and stuff, and a little bit from J.K. Rowling, but that was about it on that one. Okay, let's carry on. I'll lose myself in movie talk very quickly, guys. You can see I'm already spending too long on this. Okay, let's move on. Yeah, I'll tell you, Time Bandits is a weird one. It was one that I had to grow Anthony into appreciating because it freaked me out when I was a kid. I saw it in the theater when it first came out back in the early 80s, maybe even 1980, but it was an early movie, and it scared the hell out of me. It weirded me out. I was weirded out by that movie. But I loved the concepts of it, and I loved, and I was an avid D&D player at the time. I mean, I was hardcore D&D player. Like, I was making my own adventures and all that kind of stuff, and I was fascinated by the idea of the time journey, right, and finding these time doors you could jump through, and I wanted to incorporate that into D&D. That's what I remember from when I first saw it. All right. Yeah, big time, big time. No name in NW on that LA org executive's comment there. Okay. Well, I figured this was going to come up. Jehovah's Witness apostate. Did you see John Atack interviewing Mike Rinder? John Atack did a good job. Hope he won't get criticized. Yeah, no, of course he's getting criticized. Of course he is. That was a good interview. I did not watch the whole thing because it's drama that I'm not interested in, right? Frankly, and I really feel for Mike and the position that he's in. I think it kind of sucks what's happening right now in that whole, with that whole battle, you could say. You know, it's very, very unfortunate to me that we've created a situation in this ex-Scientology world of having to take sides. And there's, you know, the light side and the dark side, depending on who you are and where you, how you see things. And that's very, very unfortunate to me. And I really, really, really hate that that has happened. It has been a created, purposeful thing. Not by me. I've resisted it from the beginning. And you know, you get squished if you try to be in the center sometimes. And you get squished if you, you know, try to say, hey, can't we all just get along, right? Yeah, no, we can't. So what are you going to do, right? Yeah. That's what I can say about that. All right. Well, here's an interesting question. Who is a friend? Would you say there is a certain amount of mutually beneficial coercion in the relationship, or is it more of a matter of simply being nice to each other? That's an interesting question. I mean, I'm taking that just at face, like that's the question you're asking. And mutually beneficial coercion. Okay, let me say this. Human beings manipulate each other 24/7. That's what we do. We use a lot of different tools in our emotional toolkit to accomplish our purposes in going through our life. I see everyone as the hero of their own story, right? We have ego, we have intent, we have a desire to survive, to get along in life, to do whatever it is our emotional needs drive us to do. And our society and our function and our position in that society, right? It's all part of the picture. And friends are people that you are along for the ride with for a while, maybe a short while, maybe a long while. But there's a mutual understanding and support in a friendship that is a unique thing. It's a trust and a degree of loyalty and commitment to one another. Again, it could be a little tiny bit or it can be an awful lot, but it's there in some measure if you are using the word friend. And I think decide who are one's friends is the Scientology question, Anthony Spurgeon. But I think it's a good question because, see, in cults, a friend is a fellow cult member. They're not friends like I'm talking about here. A friend in a cult is just somebody who's alongside you for the ride, and you base your relationship on the mutual belief system that you both subscribe to, and that's it. That's what makes you a friend. So I suppose, in a way, the context of how we use the word determines an awful lot about how much manipulation is involved in it. Because in a cult, you will freely and gladly and happily manipulate all the people around you toward what you think is the greatest good or the cult leader's purposes or intentions, right? Command intention in Scientology. You better get on board with that. And if you have a friend in Scientology, a fellow cult member, who isn't on board with that, the friendly thing to do is work them over until they are on board with that and get on the right train, right? But in the real world, it's not like that. You know, friends in the real world understand that there are differences as well as similarities and that there are disagreements and we can agree to disagree. We can do that. We can agree to agree and we can agree to disagree. And And to the degree that I suppose we can do those things, I would be a measure of the strength of the friendship. It's an interesting way to put it. So would you say there's a certain amount of mutually beneficial coercion in the relationship? Yeah, of course there is. There always is. You know, this is the whole plug, the whole back and forth and push and pull of marriages and romantic relationships is establishing those boundaries, those power differentials, right? And who's going to be responsible for what, and who's going to take care of this and that, and who's going to be doing all of these different things, and how are we going to relate on who's going to do the shopping, who's going to do the this and that. We're sorting all that stuff out. There's all kinds of coercion going on in there. But it's not necessarily nefarious or destructive coercion, if you see what I mean. Right, it's just the little back and forths and agreements and hammering all that stuff out. That's where I can sort of that. I don't know. Just some comments on that. How is it even possible that it has already been almost an hour? I want somebody to tell me that. You guys answer that question for me because I don't understand how this time flies by so quickly. I don't even. Now, I want to get to these other questions, and there are so many of them here. These are so good. So we're going to carry on for a bit. So let's do that. I wish I had an answer to that one. I'm going to skip over a couple that I don't really have answers to. Okay. Well, okay, I'll give this one a shot. Does Tom Cruise need to have his ego stroked all the time in order to feel good? What if I met him walking down the street and said, hi, how would he treat me, with a smile or a scowl? Well, if you met him out in the street, Tom Cruise would absolutely meet you with a smile. He's an incredibly friendly and open person as far as his stage-managed public persona goes. He is a very, very friendly person. You would feel very warm and acknowledged by him, and you would feel like you were having a moment. If he was, you know, capable of having that much interaction with you, obviously context is everything here. If it was in a big line with thousands of people, well, you know, he might smile and wave, and that would be all you'd get. But if you actually managed to have a, you know, interaction with him, you'd probably think he's the world's nicest guy. When Tom Cruise is in a different context, say walking around Flag with his entourage, if you don't stop and, you know, practically salute him, somebody's going to be talking to you. You're going to have a problem. So him trying to be friendly and warm in that environment is a very different thing. He's the power player there, and he knows it, and he's in a space where he expects everyone to acknowledge his greatness. And if you don't, right, it's like Miscavige. If Miscavige walks into a room and everybody doesn't stand up, you know, people's heads are going to roll. I mean, there's going to be hell to pay. And Tom Cruise is actually no different when he's in that kind of a situation. So I'm told. I've had very clear descriptions of this, of his behavior in public and in private, and they can be very, very different. He's an incredibly goal-oriented person. That's something to understand about Tom Cruise, is he will never, ever, 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 ever interact with you or anybody else unless it serves some purpose or goal that he's trying to achieve. Because that's the life he lives. He's very on all the time, right? He's always doing something, and there's always a reason for it. I think that's important to know about somebody like him. It's one of the reasons he's gotten the position that he's in, is because he is so hyper-focused on his goals and himself. Being his main goal is him, right? And promoting himself and pushing him and his positive image and his goals, his intentions, his ideas for things. That's what he's always about. He's never about anything else but that. So, yeah, so that's what you get there. That's what Tom Cruise basically is. Okay, I'm looking forward to this one. Let me just say that, say in response to OBG Foster here, have you seen or heard the videos and audio from the Frank Hildebrandt case document dump this week? If so, what similarities with, I guess you're saying with Scientology, do you find? I did not yet look at the data dump, but I want to let you know I am keeping my finger kind of on the pulse of that case because I saw a quote from the father that the mother was like a cult leader and there's all this cult language being used to describe this behavior and that she's in an awful lot of trouble and that Hildebrandt was the cult leader, right? Okay, probably all true. But I don't think the father is going to be somebody that I want to be. I don't think he's... I think he has some responsibility for this. Let's put it that way. But I have not updated myself on the whole case yet. I plan on doing future content on that. So that's where I'm kind of at. It's sort of in the middle happening, and I'm just kind of working on other stuff right now. All right. Let's see here. Why, Xion, why do smart people believe in stupid conspiracy theories? Because they need to, because they have emotional needs that drive them to. And their intelligence only serves to reinforce all the reasons why they should believe in it, rather than give them reasons why they shouldn't. Because they're compelled to believe that this thing is true, because it helps explain or rationalize or otherwise resolve some mental or psychological distress or problem for them. Or maybe even a real world problem. That's why. That's why. That's why anybody believes in anything. So that's why I can say that's why smart people believe in conspiracy theories, because same reason. Because belief happens because of emotional needs driven by context and environment and education. Yeah, that's why. And yes, Michael Shermer's book is really good. I highly recommend it. Xion, have you considered writing a book about your own personal experiences in Scientology? I know you have lots of stories. No, I actually haven't. I'm not going to write a memoir about my experiences in Scientology. At least right now, I have no plans to do so. I know this is a real funny thing to say on YouTube, especially now, these days, with all the egos flying everywhere. And people have said so many things over the years about me that I'm sure a lot of people might hear this and think I'm completely out to lunch and have no idea what I'm talking about, but I'm going to say this anyway. My work since day one, talking about Scientology or exposing the abuses and practices and harms of it and other destructive cults that I've worked on, I've been the least important part of all of that. Me as a person in the middle of all this, I consider myself the least important part of what I'm talking about. I share my experiences and my, I give my testimonials, right, while I'm doing interviews or while I'm talking here or doing video work, because I want to share what happened to me. But it's not about me. I don't know how else to say that. And so the idea of writing my life story or a memoir about all my personal experiences with that has always struck me as the most boring thing. Why would anybody want to read that, right? So I hope I'm making myself clear here. But that's where I've always come from on this, right? And so when I wrote this book, I put chapter one together, which kind of summarizes my whole life experience in Scientology, just to kind of establish that I know what I'm talking about. That's the only reason that that chapter exists. Otherwise, I would have skipped it. Because I just wanted to get in the meat and potatoes of what Scientology is and what it does to people and how it got into that position in the first place. So anyway, that's the reasoning behind that answer. So we'll see. You know, of course, you know, 10 years from now, I might change my mind. But right now, that's where I'm at. Yes, Jono, for those that quit the RPF, are they then kicked out of the church? Yeah, pretty much. They don't have to be. They're not always declared suppressive, but they usually disappear. They don't usually come back. Yeah, right. So sometimes when people go to the RPF, they were given the choice. You're either going to be declared suppressive or you're going to do the RPF program. Up to you. Right? So they go on the RPF. And after being there for days, weeks, months, or years, they go, you know what? Fuck this. I'm out of here. Well, then they do get declared. There are other people who landed on the RPF who did not have, they were not in that much disfavor, or they hadn't screwed up that hard that it was automatic declare or RPF, right? In those cases, they might have left the RPF and routed out and done the whole little thing. They didn't run out in the middle of the night. If they took off in the middle of the night and just blew, yeah, they're going to get declared. But if they followed all the procedures, jumped through all the hoops, they could still remain in good standing with the church. Okay. Oh, what is the Scientology stance on what cancer is? Hubbard talked about cancer in a few different places, and what I remember most clearly is he talked about how there could be an obsessive create going on with the Thetan, that he would be creating things or feel like as a Thetan he needed to overcreate or overcompensate with creation, and therefore was multiplying or creating too many cells. You know, like the cancer cells that are growing out of control, right, is sort of where he was drawing that idea from. That's the first thing that came to mind. I think there are some other explanations or, you know, that he gave for cancer too, but that's the one that leaped to mind for me. He said that at one a few times. Yeah, so whatever. Rhyme and Reason, can you tell us about the obscene dog implant and Black Thetan goals? Join me on Wednesday at 1 o'clock and I'll tell you all about it. I got pages of this stuff to tell you guys about. And we will definitely be talking about those. Yes. The cover picture on the Dianetics book has an exploding volcano. Isn't that about Scientology OT3 lore as opposed to Dianetics? Yes, it is. That is absolutely about restimulating people's Xenu, so that they will be drawn unconsciously and, you know, sort of subliminally to the book and feel compelled to buy it and read it because of the volcano thing. Sure. Yeah. That is true. That's what Hubbard thought. Okay. Okay, Red Pill 3000, does Scientology involve any wacky endorsements of vitamin supplements and similar stuff? Yes, it does. Heavily and repeatedly and often. Hubbard was a big proponent of vitamins. He included a whole regimen of vitamin A, D, C, B complex, B1, calcium, magnesium, what else? A few others. Into a mix that was that you would be delivered on the purification rundown, right? In ever-increasing doses. Oh, multivitamin and a couple other things. And a lot of Scientologists take that as a sort of mandate for taking vitamins all the time, right? And they take vitamins often. Vitamin C. They love vitamin C. Oh my God, every time. Okay, let me tell you, my own story and lots of other people in Scientology, you get sick, you start pounding down the vitamin C, and I mean pounding it down. In fact, I would myself personally for many, many years did this and told other people, if they got sick or weren't feeling well, here's the formula. You super saturate your body with vitamin C. You take 1,000 milligrams, a gram of C right off, and you do it every hour. You just take 1,000 milligrams every hour on the hour until your body is rejecting it, which will be manifested by, you know, loose, you know, diarrhea. And a few other signs, but mostly your body's, you know, telling you that way. And then you cut it back to every other hour. And you keep taking it, right? And you just kill those germs or disease or whatever with vitamin C. And I very naively, very stupidly believe this. And I would abuse my body with vitamin C this way. Because I justified it by, somebody told me one time, and I believed it was true, that it was impossible to OD on vitamin C because your body will just get rid of the excess. And so you want to just super saturate your cells with it. So there you go. So that's the thing. Oh, are we still getting leather pant comments? Okay. Yeah, those are a little bit odd. Joe DiCeppo, which other cults do you have planned to cover now that you're moving on from making a majority of Scientology-related content? Asking for a friend. Okay, I'm going to start. I want to start with the mainstream ones and then drill down after I get done with those. So I want to cover the Moonies, the Unification Church. I want to cover the Jehovah's Witnesses. I want to cover the Mormons. Those are the three I have on my list to start with. They are not the only ones, but those are the main ones I want to start with, and really go deep. You know, really break down the history, the dogma, the control mechanisms and structures. How are they a cult then and now? What are the frameworks of control that they have in place? I have analyzed this Scientologically, you know, in the auditing sessions and the confessionals. And I want to do the same for those groups, right? I feel like I can sit here and I can tell you why an auditing session or why Scientology auditing is so wrong because of the control structures and mechanisms that are in place, basically. I don't want to sound all, you know, highfalutin or whatever, but that's how I talk. That's what it is. There are control structures. I think those same things exist in these other groups. In fact, I know they do, and I want to figure out what the anatomy of them is, and show you guys, right? You know, we talk about their abuses and the certainly the financial rapaciousness of the Mormon Church is epic and legendary, far exceeds Scientology's. But it's more than just money, and it's more than just, you know, troublesome or problematic interviews with kids. There's all kinds of other things going on in the Mormon Church that are heavy control mechanisms for their members. And I want to break all that down, right? There's the salacious, weird stuff, too, like the rituals and the temple ceremonies and stuff like that I think might be, you know, worth looking into and sort of breaking down. A lot of people have done some of that work already or have done a lot of that work, and I want to get up to speed on some of that. So I'm kind of thinking along those lines, and then I'm also looking at what else comes up, right? There's internet cults. Where I want to dive deeper on those. We've talked about Stephen Molyneux and Teal Swan and some of these people who get away with running these scams on the internet and really building up cults of personality around themselves and then selling products or merch or workshops and seminars and services and this kind of thing, all built around very, very problematic dogma, right? Very, very abusive practices. We see this in that Radical Honesty group. That's a group I want to do some stuff on. So once I get the big mainstream guys covered, or at least I'm sort of thinking covering those guys to start with, we can then dive into maybe more smaller or other forms of cults and activities. The other thing I want to do going along with this, or going, you know, interspersed with that, is more work on domestic violence, the coercive control in domestic intimate partner violence situations. And I'd love to do a few shows on the gang trafficking side of this too. So those are kind of where my mind goes when I think about this stuff into the future. All right. When will you have John Atack on again? I don't know, soon. Sooner than later. All right. And well, here's an interesting question. What do you think it really means to be a good person? I feel like to be a truly good person, one has to be so purely because they want to be, not because of a threat reward, afterlife, karma, etc. Well, there's an interesting point, Joe. You know, there's be good for goodness sake, right? Better be good for goodness sake. And goodness is its own reward, right? And that kind of thing. But we have to get along in the world, right? We have to survive. We have to eat, sleep, be merry for ourselves. We have to get those, we have to collect those resources. And the way we do that is we service others. We exchange. Other people have things we want, we have things other people want. And to the degree that we engage in tit-for-tat behavior, that's the game theory that all life is kind of built on. Tit-for-tat. I give, you give. You give, I give, right? Back and forth. When you examine people's behavior, when I have examined people's behavior across cultures, across time, it seems to me that the universal concept of good is maintaining an even flow of tit for tat. It's not letting that fall out of balance. And it's funny how our emotional needs, especially the need of justice, kick in so hard when that equation falls out of balance way too far. One could even define abuse as allowing that equation to fall out of balance too far. You're abusing me. You're taking too much from me. You're asking too much of me. You're demanding I do or give, or provide, or be more than I am capable of giving, or that I am giving back. It feels like we're out of parity, we're out of exchange, we're unbalanced in our relationship in some way, right? This is a way people think about and define what is acceptable or good for them. And I think our ideas and concepts of good, or what we think of as good in any kind of context we run into, is very much measured by this. Are we in balance? Are we in harmony, exchange with other people? So I don't think, if I look at it this way, if I frame it this way, and when I think about good, bad, right, wrong, this is how I think about it, then I think we're looking for that balance. And I think that we pretty universally look for that, right? And so we can define good as through that lens. So I think that I think if we're sort of thinking, well, we should just be good just for ourselves, just for the sake of it. Well, sure, you can stand on a street corner and be really good all day long to people, smile, wave, hi, all that. But if it's not going to get any food or rest or shelter or transportation, then, you know, is it good for you to do that? Right? Maybe not. Right? Where's the exchange? Where's the tit for tat? So I don't know that it's an inherently bad or wrong thing to expect to get something back for what one does, as long as one is not expecting to receive everything back, right? Well, I did this good thing for you, so you now owe me everything. That would be another imbalance, right? That's kind of how I think about it in terms of what is good versus what is bad. And I base all that on that game theory principle of tit for tat. I think that that is the most basic equation of all life. You know, I think, I don't know why life evolved, but I know that life evolved on that principle. I really do. I just think it's so basic. I think it's the most basic, fundamental, simple computation or thought process, really, you know, that a life unit can have, even all the way down to cells. You know, hey, you're taking from me and not giving back, right? And you know, like that, I think it motivates an awful lot of behavior all the way down to that level. And I think that's why I think about these bigger concepts in that way. Okay. And finally, we have two more questions and then we'll wrap up today. Any plans for movie reviews in the future? Really liked your Ghostbusters 2016 review. I do not have any plans to do dedicated movie reviews, but I do have plans to do content, video work in the future about how cults are represented in entertainment. And those would be kind of cinematic review type videos of movies and TV shows that feature cultic activity as sort of a thematic element. And I want to discuss that stuff and how good or bad they do with it. I think there's a whole series of work there. And I have been thinking about doing that for years now. And that's also another possibility of future work. I've got, you know, lots of shows listed out to do that with. I just need the time to do it. Okay. And then finally, we have another of the questions. Let's go to the preset questions that I set up here. This is also from Matt B, just because it's a really good one. So I wanted to make sure that I got an answer in on this one today before we wrap up. So let's go ahead and pull it up on screen. The successful corruption of local authorities, the LAPD, East Grinstead Local Council, Clearwater Police Force, by Scientology has been well documented. While Scientology has on at least one instance infiltrated a national level authority in the United States, Operation Snow White, it seems they have been more successful in corrupting local level authorities. What explains the greater success of Scientology or cults in general in corrupting local authorities? Okay, so basically, I think the answer to this question is that it's easier because there are less stakes or consequences at the local level than there are at the state or federal level. So as you go up the hierarchy, so to speak, of power and influence, it becomes harder to sway the individuals involved and to corrupt them because they are responsible for more people. There are more safeguards in place for their personal job activities. There is more oversight, in other words. There's more regulations, in other words, for people at a state or federal level than there are at a local level. And the watchdogs and police forces or regulatory agencies are usually a bit more on the ball as you move up the chain, right? There's more people involved in regulatory activities and stuff like that. It's harder to get away with, in other words. It's a lot harder to bribe a federal senator than it is a state senator. It's a lot harder to bribe a state senator than it is a city council member. You need more money. It's harder to get access to them. Once you do get access to them, it's harder to sell them on your thing because they are involved in so many things. The higher up they go, the bigger their influence and the broader their programs and ideas and goals, right? So Scientology tends to be pretty small time in its concentrated goals. It only wants protection for itself. So that's why it has to ally with other groups and interfaith activities and stuff like that to get any attention at all when it comes to some bigger stuff. Now, we had heard during the Trump administration that there had been infiltration all the way into the White House of Scientologists getting, you know, bending Trump's ear for a period. That was very short-lived. So it's possible to get up into that stratosphere and do your nasty work and have and peddle influence there. But you know, but it kind of took a Trump in office to make that happen. It was a lot harder to do when you have, you know, more legitimate, longer term, you know, leaders and politicians who kind of know the ropes and know what they're doing a bit more, and they're a little less corrupt, inherently speaking, right? I don't care who you are. If you can't recognize Donald Trump as a corrupt individual, then I just don't have any other words for you. He's so obviously corrupt. So, but I think in general terms, it's harder to get to that level and do that kind of stuff. And also, it's they're more accessible. I mean, you get to reach a mayor or a city council person, set an appointment. You know, you can get to these people very easily. Try getting to a federal senator or even a House of Representatives member one-on-one, right? It's hard, much more challenging. So just the logistics of it make it easier to do. Also, this because the stakes tend to be lower and the person doesn't have as much power or influence at the lower, you know, say city council level, you know, you get them a helicopter ride with Tom Cruise and they're on cloud nine, you know. You offer something like that to a federal senator, it's not like they don't want to take a helicopter ride with Tom Cruise. But they take helicopter rides with lots of people. So, you know, you kind of get my drift there, right? So, so there you go, right? So that's kind of my answer on that one is it's just because it, what explains the greater success? Because it's easier. That's why, you know, really. All right, let's go back over here to our list. Pull that one down. And, oh, here we go. Okay, go back to our host and chat screen here. All right, so I think we have reached the limit of our questions here. Oh, nope, Joe, you got me. There was one more question. What's that book and what's the gossip about consultations, Chris? Thank you for asking. Okay, so this, let me just do some shameless self-promotion as we wrap up the show. This is my book, my Scientology A to Xenu. If you want to understand Scientology at a level that, you know, that's pretty good, deep, fundamental understanding, this would be the book for you. I always push this and John Atack's A Piece of Blue Sky. And between these two books, you are really going to get the whole picture of what's up with this thing. There's stuff in here that isn't anywhere else. There's a chapter in here that breaks down the OT levels and all the stuff about that that isn't anywhere else. And there's also a full explanation in here about the tax exemption, for example, right? So anyway, hope you'll check that out. And then, of course, you can also... oh, Plone for Good is here? Wow. Yes, have the officials dance with John Travolta. Absolutely. Wow. Hey, Mark, glad you're here. So read Blown for Good too. That's always a good one. Excellent. Okay. So, yeah, so that's in there. And then of course there's my consultation. He comes in just at the end. This is awesome. Mark, we got to get together on camera. We have to do that. I'm just going to say that right now. Okay. Consultations. So you can contact me personally and I will help you. If you are looking for some help, guidance, direction, advice, I just talked to a person this week, a couple people this week, actually. I had a couple consultations about people who wanted help with their family members. How do I talk to them? What do I do? How do we get them out? Right. We started that conversation with a couple different people this week, as well as other kind of consultation where I can just work with you and help you and walk through coercive situations that maybe you've been involved in and breaking it down and figuring it out and how to move on from it. I can do that work. I don't do counseling. I don't do therapy, but I do pretty much everything else. So anyway, you can contact me for that. All right, guys. So, hey, thanks. Thanks, Mark. All right, man. I'm just gonna be leaving on a high here today. All right, but yeah, we do need to wrap up. So so let's do so. On that happy note, let's see here. Let me pull that off. So you will have after Scientology Straight Up and Vertical tomorrow, me and Tony, and then you will have on Wednesday Speaking of cults, live stream podcast right here, 1 o'clock. Join me. We'll go over all the sci-fi. All of it. We're just going to do this thing, right? And on that happy note, I'll see you guys soon. Bye-bye.